Welcome to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak. Today we're going to continue our exploration of the relational shift, the spreading awareness that physical reality, including us, is far more dynamically interrelated than our modern culture had thunked. We'll focus today on Buddhism in America. Of course, a strong case can be made that all religions teach that everything is interrelated. Some say we're all kin because the Creator made everything. Some say that the world is interrelated because everything in it is infused with divine grace. Buddhism, though, like indigenous spiritual worldviews, emphasizes the realization that dynamic interrelatedness of all being is at the center of its spiritual practice. So, for those of you who don't know anything about Buddhism, I'll start this program with a brief account of what the Buddha was up to. And really, the best way for me to do that, so that I don't leave out anything important, is to read you a very abridged version of a passage from the chapter on Buddhism in a book I wrote in 1991, States of Grace. To set the scene a bit, I'll first add that the Buddha's name was Gautama. The title, the Buddha, came later. He's thought to have been born in 563 BCE. And after observing the anguish and inner suffering of people, he determined to find out how to alleviate the suffering. So he spent several years studying meditation practices with two prominent Hindu teachers in his area. He excelled in the practices they taught, but Gautama realized that although he had purified his mind at the surface level, negativities, impurities, complexes still existed at the deep, deep levels of his mind. So, here the plot thickens. One evening, Gautama, then 35 years of age, seated himself under a towering poplar fig tree and resolved not to move until he had observed the true nature of mind and attained liberation from human misery. He began that long night, he later revealed in his teaching of meditation, by observing his respiration, moving from gross to subtle awareness, and by observing the contents of the mind and the sensations on and in the body. When his concentration brought his conscious mind in contact with the deeper levels of mind, he was able to go deep inside the mental processes until the illusion of solidity was dissected and dissolved by his unwavering attention. He saw that mental contents, as well as the physical structure of the body, were in constant flux and were composed of trillions of micro-events, extraordinarily minute particles or movements of energy arising and passing away with great rapidity. He saw that human consciousness is by nature completely pure, but becomes marred by defilements of hatred, greed, and delusion that manifest through reactive mental processes. When he was able to bring his conscious mind in contact with the deeper levels through subtle, direct observation in meditation, he saw that it is possible for the conscious mind to cultivate awareness that the minute, moment-to-moment sensations are transitory. Hence, there's no point in clinging to them. Hence, they need not be reacted to. Bare awareness of the subtle sensations without judging them bad or good, and thereby calling forth more reactive emotions, breaks the chain reaction and gradually eradicates habitual patterns of response, which are the cause of deep complexes. As Gautama continued to intervene in his own reactive mental processes simply with unbroken awareness, he saw that the mind becomes purified as the patterns of reaction are weakened, and as the judgmental evaluating process becomes correspondingly less intense. As he progressed and the deep habitual patterns of reaction were eradicated, his entire mental structure became filled with the qualities of a liberated mind: pure love, infinite compassion, joy in the joy of others, and equanimity. He continued to progress to subtler and subtler levels of awareness until he arrived at experiential knowledge of the ultimate truth. that matter and energy, constituting mental contents, the physical structure of the body, forms manifested in the surrounding universe, are nothing but vibration and oscillation. He saw that this truth of the entire universe can be experienced within the framework of the body. Still, he went further and experienced the fading away and cessation of craving, the end of suffering, the perception beyond conditions of arising and passing away, that is, the unconditioned state of nibbana or nirvana. At dawn, a Buddha arose. Gautama was henceforth called by that title, the enlightened one, the awakened one, by all who heard him. Filled with love and compassion for the suffering of all beings, Gautama Buddha spent the remaining 45 years of his life teaching the practical method by which people can observe the nature of the mind, the cause of suffering, and the cessation of suffering. He claimed no inspiration from any god or external power, attributing his realization and achievement to human endeavor and human intelligence. He taught that empirical observation of cause and effect regarding the human psyche and behavior, rather than notions of divine intervention, offers a sure path beyond anguish. So that's how it all began, folks. And the Buddha then began teaching a small group of people about his meditation technique of clear insight, and soon many people were coming to hear him and practice with him, many of them becoming nuns, monks, and teachers of meditation. Eventually, the technique was spread from North India to Burma or Myanmar to Thailand, Cambodia, Vietnam, as well as north to Tibet, China, Korea, and Japan. Every time Buddhism jumped a border and entered a new country, it took on cultural characteristics of that society. Over here, Zen Buddhism was brought to popular awareness in the 1950s, Tibetan Buddhism in the late 1960s and on, and Theravada Buddhism, the southern school of Buddhism, from which this mindfulness meditation technique arises and is practiced all across South Asia, it became established over here in the 1970s. And from that point, also, something else happened. Various versions of mindfulness meditation have been extrapolated from the technique I just described and applied within many medical and psychotherapeutic settings across the United States with impressive and highly replicable results. A lot of people have been helped, even with that partial version. It's that effective. My guest today is Wes Nisker. He's a teacher of Buddhist meditation, an author, radio commentator, and comedic performer. His books include Essential Crazy Wisdom and The Big Bang, The Buddha, and The Baby Boom, and Buddha's Nature, as well as his latest, Crazy Wisdom Saves the World Again, which is also a CD and a DVD. In addition, Wes Nisker is the co-founder with Barbara Gates and is the editor-at-large of the National Buddhist Journal, Inquiring Mind, a periodical that's really well done and I highly recommend. Wes Nisker is an affiliate teacher of mindfulness meditation, also known as insight meditation, also known as Buddhist Vipassana meditation, at the Spirit Rock Meditation Center in Woodacre, California, near San Francisco. For the past several years, Wes Nisker has been performing a comic monologue entitled Crazy Wisdom Saves the World Again, about which a review in the New York Times said, quote, his performance, laced with his original songs, manages to make suffering a knee slapper. He delivers Zen zingers with borscht belt timing, unquote. Now, Wes Nisker is also known in the San Francisco Bay Area by his radio name, Scoop Nisker, because from 1968 to 1980, he composed and delivered brilliant five-minute collages of the daily news on a radio station with his insightful, hilarious commentary. And believe me, the Bay Area was tuned in for Scoop Nisker's daily take on what was happening. He ended those news collages with what became his famous tagline.
If you don't like the news, go out and make some of your own.
Right, thank you. I've thought recently when looking at the Occupy people on the news on the West Coast that maybe some of them were in their cribs as their parents were listening to Scoop Nisker's daily news collage. They'd be lying in their crib pondering, Goo-goo gaga, if I don't like the news, go out and make some of my own. Goo-goo gaga. Uh-huh. So, dear listeners, you're about to find out what happens when a comedic performer becomes a Buddhist meditation teacher. Wes Nisker, welcome to All Together Now.
Thank you, Charlene. It's really good to be here and good to talk to you. I love radio, and as an old friend, I really appreciated your introduction to Buddhism. It was quite thorough and comprehensive, shall we say.
Okay, but I'm quite interested in learning about the spin that you've put on it. Let's start where the big guy did when he started to teach with the Four Noble Truths. What's your take on the First Noble Truth?
Well, being Jewish, I was attracted to Buddhism, I think, because of the First Noble Truth, which is the truth of suffering. The Buddha said that everyone who is born will have to suffer disappointment, dissatisfaction, pain, old age, sickness, and death. And for me, it was a relief to read that First Noble Truth because I realized that I haven't been singled out for special punishment, that we're all in this together, you know, and misery loves company. But I think because, partly because I'm Jewish, and there are a lot of Jewish people involved in Buddhism in the West, that First Noble Truth had a special ring because Jews are, you know, famous for kvetching. I sometimes call it the First Noble Kvetch, you know. But now with Buddhism, I can kvetch in Pali as well as Yiddish. You know, I've learned another way to complain about this incarnation. So the First Noble Truth, I think, really, if you penetrate it. And what the Buddha was really trying to say is that be realistic about this life. Look at the facts. And the facts are not particularly heartwarming or optimistic. We all know that we're going to die. And we have these bodies. And, of course, we get pleasure and there's joy in life. But the end, we are aware of the end. We're the only species, it seems, that knows that we're going to come to an end, and it's a great cause of anxiety and sadness, and a lot of psychologists have said that's the core bottom line fear that drives us, is this knowledge of death.
Thought there's a gender correlation with that. I think what you just described is a little stronger in the male psyche. I'm not sure why, but it's true. It's what lies ahead of us. And one of the things I noticed when I came back from India very long ago was how this culture is so full of distractions, so people don't have to do what you just said. Look suffering right in the face. Not only that we're going to die, but things that we really like pass away, moments we love pass away. Everything is just arising in order to come to fruition and pass away. So we can't freeze the way we would like things to be. There's that evanescence of the fading moment. And it just seems more and more in this culture, it's like, you have a little bit of dissatisfaction in your mind, try this video game, buy this thing, do that. So I think, just getting people to cut through that and see what you were talking about is a task over here.
Right, it is. And there's no doubt about it. Our culture really sort of runs on the idea that you can live happily ever after, that you can find a state of ultimate security, ultimate joy, happiness, constant pleasure. That, and I think that that's partly why so many young people started to study Buddhism was, well, the material goods didn't do it for us, and they didn't do it for our parents, and maybe Buddhism will lead us to some kind of constant, endless happiness. And
yeah, that's interesting, because my daughter's generation, I saw what you just said. They're first inundated in their teens, and she said, through the 20s, what happened was you saw that the $300 purse didn't make you happy. You know, there was
right.
a rush initially. And so it's almost like the Buddhist path in this country is first the inundation, then the falling away of that, and then a search for, well, if not that, then what, you know?
Right. And I think if anything, our culture is a proof of that first noble truth that, you know, that the goods and the pleasures don't last, and that there's got to be, you know, that's not the answer. We've lived in a time of unprecedented freedom and abundance, and people are, the rates of depression are higher, and the unhappiness is rampant. You know, people are not are not finding the satisfaction that was promised by material wealth and abundance.
And there's no way for them to suspect that you can, like, look through it, go, you know, right through it to another state of being. And I understand, I saw on YouTube, and there was a musical way you've conveyed this, and I wonder if you could share that with us.
You'd like me to sing?
I would like you to sing a cappella, that Buddha blues.
Oh, okay. I would be glad to. I wish I had my, accompanying band with me, but I don't. So I'll just sing the blues for you. Woke up this morning, there was trouble in my mind. I tried some meditation, but no peace could I find. Called up my guru, I asked him what to do. He said, son, you just gotta remember that first noble truth. You were born to suffer. You were born to sing some blues. And that path goes on forever when you got the Buddha blues. Now, the Christian people believe you go to heaven or you go to hell. The Jews believe the Messiah's yet to come, gonna judge this life so well. Some people believe it don't mean nothing in the end, but the Buddha done told me I'm gonna come back and do it again and again and again. Be reborn to suffer. Be reborn to pay my dues. And that path keeps getting longer when you got the Buddha blues. Now we're all born in ignorance, in a world of greed and hate. Maybe things will get better when we reincarnate. We won't have so many problems. Next life will be fine, as long as we don't get a body, Lord. As long as we don't get a mind. Won't have to suffer so much. Won't have to pay so many dues. That path could get a little shorter. Won't have so many Buddha blues.
Just right for our culture.
Yes, yes.
I'm going to insert here the rest of the noble truth so the listeners aren't wondering, okay, I've got the first one down, but they never talked about it. So I'll just put this in here. The four noble truths. The first is that suffering is with us throughout this life. The second noble truth, the cause of suffering is desire, craving, or aversion. Third noble truth, the way out of suffering is the way beyond desire, beyond craving and aversion. The fourth noble truth, that way is the Eightfold Noble Path. And the Eightfold Noble Path that the Buddha delineated has three sections to it, morality, meditation, and wisdom. So under morality, there's right speech, right action, right livelihood. Under meditation, right concentration, right mindfulness, right effort. And under wisdom, right understanding, right thought. And the growth of each of these strengthens the others, and together they comprise the path known as the middle way, which is the avoiding of extremes of either asceticism or indulgence. And the interesting thing is that even after clearing away, you know, these negative reactive habits of the mind, which, as the Buddha discovered, can be weakened just by observing them, then you're not feeding them with more emotional juice, you might think, well, you'd end up with a neutral mind then that's not, you know, going in either direction. But in fact, people end up with a deep happiness and compassion for all beings. I think that's something that's really beyond what science can explain. They can say, oh, yes, you lay down these synaptic patterns, and you just start laying down other synaptic patterns, or you stop strengthening them. But why do you arrive in compassion for the world and this deep happiness? I think that's the true gem of Buddhism.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, the key is that third noble truth, that what the Buddha discovered was this power of mind that we all have, but are unaware of, this power of mind to sort of step outside of the psyche and simply observe. And that, you know, it was an evolutionary leap to discover this power that we have and to begin to apply it and use it as a kind of scientist. You know, I think the Buddha really was using the scientific method, being as objective as you can be when you're in mindfulness, when you're observing yourself. You're as objective as you can be about yourself as the subject.
Mm-hmm.
And so he's like a naturalist, and I'm going into the wilderness of myself, and I'm just going to observe what's there.
Right.
And in the process of doing that, I think that what happens is there's several things that happen. One is that it no longer is quite so personal. You start to realize that you are not creating your patterns of thinking. They're old. You know, they're based on the instincts we inherit as an animal, a mammal. They're based on the habits we get when we're raised, and psychological habits. And so we don't own them. They're not ours. And once we begin to see that, it lessens their hold on us. We really realize that we are slaves to the old karma. And then we can start to extract ourselves and really understand our identity as universal as you know, our fear and our sorrow and our desire are generic.
Mm-hmm.
So if they're not I, me, mine, then we don't have to pay so much attention to them. We can gain some freedom from mm-hmm. their dictates. And that was an evolutionary leap that the Buddha made. And now we are beginning to science is beginning to substantiate all of these claims that have been made over the centuries by individuals who have practiced mindfulness meditation.
Right.
We're starting to understand what happens in the brain, and that indeed people are changing the patterns of their mind so that they can actually live with more freedom, more ease, and are not driven by this stimulus response mechanism, the pleasure principle, whatever you want to call it. I like to think of it as instinctual, that mm-hmm. we found a way to overcome the instincts that have grown up over millions of years of living beings on this planet. And that's a breakthrough.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, when you describe it that way, it's as if, you know, we take the human-animal processes that tend to happen in every culture, and he cuts through those processes. The Buddha cuts through those processes. So he's discovering this vibratory, subtle level of material existence within the body, which is throughout the whole universe. It's almost as if it opens you up from your small human-animal self to connecting with these processes of the whole cosmos arising and passing away. And moment to moment, you know, everything being reformed. So I think, as I understand, you bring science in when you teach Buddhism, and a lot of the Buddhist meditation Buddhist meditation teachers in Burma and elsewhere, they were very interested all through the 20th century on the developments in 20th century physics because they saw the parallels with what the Buddha had discovered.
Yes, absolutely. And, I especially in the 70s, there was a lot of talk about how Asian wisdom traditions and physics, quantum physics, were really meeting in a kind of agreement of the nature of reality. I think, though, that even more important and more accessible to us is the biological understanding and the fact that we begin to see our own organism as developed and constituted by the past of life on this planet,
right?
And that we've come to a place where perhaps we can shift the karma and take it into our own hands. If there's any freedom at all, perhaps we do have a choice as to whether to, follow every desire or not.
Mm-hmm. Well,
so
it's interesting.
And I think, go ahead.
Go ahead. Go ahead.
Yeah, you know, we're at a place. I think we're in a transition time, going from one mythology to a new one. You know, the old mythology is about your individual soul, and it's about the fact that we as humans are specially created. We're separate from the rest. Most of our modern religion, most of our religious traditions consider the earth a kind of training planet, you know, where you come to burn off some karma or learn some lessons, then go on to some other place where you truly belong. But we're starting to tell ourselves this new story, which is based on science, so it must be true. No, just kidding. But it is. It's based on science. It's observable. It's testable. And we see that, you know, we are part of this biosphere. We are interrelated to everything that lives on this planet. And we start to lose that sense of individuality that we've reached a sort of extreme of that individualism in our culture, and it's time to move back into a sense of being part of the great dance of all life, or the great cosmic show, however you want to frame it.
Right. I was going to say before, when you were talking about karma, we should probably explain what's known as karma in the United States is a really reduced, almost comic book version. You do something to somebody, it comes back to you, whether good or bad. But what they mean by karma in the Buddhist cultures is, you know, all the interrelationships through the universe, everything in the past moments, all moving forward into the next moment, you know, your next moment, and the next moment of every entity. So it's hugely complex, way beyond the human mind. And you were saying, you know, I wonder if we can influence it. And I thought, well, that's interesting, because that's what Whitehead said. He's the only Western philosopher who really tried to work with the new physics and say, what does this mean? It's arising every moment. So I had this thought that you could do a great comedic riff on Whitehead's tome, Process and Reality, but I think I'll leave that thought there for now. We have to stop a minute here for the break, and then we'll be right back. Welcome back to All Together Now. This is Charlene Spretnak speaking with my guest, Wes Nisker, also known in his role as a radio commentator as Scoop Nisker. His website, by the way, is wesnisker.com. That's WESNISKER.com or scoopnisker.com. There's lots of information there about his teaching dates, performance dates, books, CDs, DVDs. Now, as a Buddhist meditation teacher, Wes Nisker has a lot to say about the clinging and craving, all the stuff, The baby boomers love to love. He's put those observations into a song we'll hear now. This is from his CD and DVD called Crazy Wisdom Saves the World Again. This is The Boomer Song, written and performed by Wes Nisker.
You can go anywhere you want to go, eat anything you want to eat, own anything you want to own. That's right, you can be anyone you want to be the president of the USA, or be bent any which way. You can be a fool, be cool, be a somebody or nobody home, a contender or pretender to the throne, be a drone or the queen bee. Be a buyer, a seller, a singer, or a teller of tales, or a lifter of bales. Be a banker, a golfer, a wanker, a rolfer, a CEO, a CPA, an SOB, an MFA. Or really go far and be a rock and roll star. Or maybe you could even be a deity. Be God by God. Then you can be everyone you want to be simultaneously. Because you can be, you can own, you can eat, you can go, you can own. Oh, yeah. You can own anything you want to own. Own a house or three, maybe 20 TVs. Get a piece of the rock. Why not own a whole block? You could even own a wilderness. And I guess a mountain could be yours, or a lake, or an island. You could even own a country of your own. Call it my land. Own a 1,000 pair of shoes, any cure for the blues, the pills, the thrills. Don't worry about the bills. You got credit cards, checks. You can even pay in dollars if there's anything you want. Just holler. Own a classic piece of art, the original rendition, or the first edition of your favorite creation. And maybe you could even buy yourself a revelation. Or buy yourself a new start, a new part, a new nose, a new chin, a new heart, a new do, a new you. Cause you can be, you can own, you can eat, you can go, you can be, you can eat. Oh, you can eat anything you want to eat. You are the main man, top of the food chain man. You can eat high on the hog, eat the legs of the frog, the brains or the stomach or the toes of any creature that you meet. And if you don't like their color, you can dye them before you fry them. And if you don't like their texture, you can get them tenderized before you bite into their thighs. Have some fauna, some flora. Come on, have some mora, have some fowl, some fish. Have another dish, and don't forget the cow. And how would you like that prepared? In a steak, or a burger, or a stew, or moo-shoo. You are the main man, an American man. You can eat any cuisine on the planetary scene. Japanese, Javanese, Indian, Armenian. Fast food, hot food, raw food. You got food, so eat. And then go. Yeah, because you can go on vacation just to visit any nation. Take a notion, get in motion, and just go to the mountains or the prairies or the oceans white with foam. Leave home. Now, you could go to Walla Walla, but I don't know why you'd want to when you could go to Oaxaca or get a nice palapa in Hawaii or Fiji. Well, why not go to Fuji and go diving in the reefs or roll yourself a spleef in Jamaica or take a nice safari to Nairobi or the Gobi? Or go up the Himalaya to Shambhala, or up the Alps to Valhalla, or go visit the Maori, or go looking for Satori in Japan, man. Oh, yeah, but if you really, truly want to, you could travel to Nirvana. That's right. And escape the desires of this crazy creation. Uh-huh. Get off the wheel of birth and death and reincarnation. Uh-huh. Get off the wheel that keeps you always being and owning and eating and going and being and owning and eating and going and get off the wheel. Get off the wheel.
Okay, thanks, Wes. I find it impossible not to move to that. I wonder if the Buddha would have the same reaction. I think so.
Well, you know, it relates so much to what we were talking about earlier in the First Noble Truth. And what I try to impart to people is that, you know, we are, first of all, we're a baby species. We're pretty young. And, you know, our brains didn't come, these big brains didn't come with a good instruction manual. And so, this whole process of trying to understand ourselves and apply mindfulness and get free of our past. Those things are very difficult and we're new at it. It's a brand new game. So you should constantly forgive yourself and don't expect to, you know, take a meditation course and then suddenly be mindful every moment of your day. And it's pretty much, again, it's sort of the substitute of the American dream that you're going to find a blissful state and stay there. It doesn't work that way. And I think a lot of us over the last 40 years of trying to understand these practices of meditation have come to that understanding that, you know, you can do a lot. You can change a lot in terms of your approach to the world, your attitudes, your emotions, but it doesn't come easy.
Huh, yeah. I wonder if you have found a correlation with what cognitive science and just surveys of people over 60 find. A lot of people in their 80s have said that their happiest two decades were their 60s and 70s. Presumably because their reactive brain chemistry slows down by then, and we're not as reactive. And these are this is the happy zone, 60 to 80. So I wonder if you find meditators over 60 having a little easier time, but or if they've sort of ebbed on the concentration powers by that time.
I think that, yeah, I think it's a grace, you know, one of the gifts of getting older. And perhaps it's because people are a little more relaxed, you know, they don't have to prove themselves or, you know, they've come to some kind of compromise with life. And so they aren't quite as aggressive. They step out of that aggressive doing mind and are able to relax a little more and just be. That may be the key to it.
Yeah. Well, I'd like to move over into this other area you're involved with, and that's your work on the Buddhist journal, Inquiring Mind. I really love Inquiring Mind. It's going to be 30 years old next year. And it's so beautifully edited, and the layout, it's on oversized paper. It seems like just a very calm, oceanic, graphic layout to it, and the quality is excellent, the aesthetics. And it's also very interesting that you and Barbara Gates made a decision from the beginning to run it on a principle of Dana, D-A-N-A, which in South Asia Buddhist cultures is donation, basically, but the idea is Buddhist teachings are never charged for. There's never an upfront money charge to learn how to do Buddhist meditation. On the contrary, at the end of a 10-day or whatever meditation retreat, people make donations based on whether they feel the practice was effective, if they feel gratitude for it, and if they'd like to help the next people who will come through the meditation center. So it all works on donations of people who understand what the practice is and are engaged in the practice. And for your journal, you do it all through donations instead of a set subscription fee, which I think is remarkable in this country, and it is,
and it's been a bit of a challenge both in the publishing of the journal and as keeping the journal alive, but also in my own teaching meditation, that we don't set a fee, we don't charge for our teaching, and we keep ourselves alive by what people donate. It's a concept that there's a beauty in it, and we've tried to maintain it because we didn't want to have Buddhism succumb to the, you know, the money value exchange of the West. And
right.
I think we've done a pretty good job so far.
Yeah, very good job. And I wanted to tell people that the website is inquiringmind.com. Inquiring with an I, inquiringmind.com. And I'd like to ask you, since you've had this sort of a bird's eye view of the Buddhist landscape, mostly the Vipassana community, but also beyond that, over these 30 years of doing that journal, how do you see that the journal Inquiring Mind and the Buddhist community have changed over that period?
Well, it's like watching a revolution. If you look at the first couple issues of The Inquiring Mind way back in 1984, you see that there are maybe five meditation retreats in our tradition are listed. There are a couple sitting groups, weekly sitting groups listed in the Bay, San Francisco Bay Area and New York and Boston. And now there's page after page of listings of sitting, weekly sitting groups in all the major cities and lots of not so major cities and hundreds of offerings of meditation retreats and with different themes, how to deal with the critical mind and, you know, understanding nature and meditation. And it's just exploded. It's been a real, I think a revolution is a not too grandiose a term to use for what's happened in the last 30 years in this country around all of these Eastern Asian wisdom practices. I mean, look at the yoga centers. I mean, there were a couple yoga studios in San Francisco when I moved here in the late 60s, and now they're on every corner virtually. Mm-hmm. I mean, you. Mm-hmm. Get your ice cream cone and go to yoga. Anyway, it's really quite astonishing, and the journal has grown.
It's become more diverse too. Let's just add that, don't you think?
Oh, absolutely, absolutely.
Much
and
more.
The teachings of meditation have gone into various communities, African American communities, and. Of course, the Asian communities—they were here first with these practices. They brought them over from Asia, but it's really been quite exciting to be part of it. You know,
mm-hmm.
this awakening of the West, if you want to call it that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
We've tried to cover, you know, the major movements, the major trends in the transference of the Buddhist teachings to the West. So we've done issues on Buddhism and psychology, Buddhism and physics, Buddhism and the environment, Buddhism and politics. Every angle, and then we've repeated them. You know, every decade we do an issue on every theme that we've ever thought of.
Oh, it'd be interesting to put those together and see it as a spiral, evolving spiral on each of those issues. Yeah, I wanted to get to that too. The idea that Buddhism is not only about looking inward, but because compassion for the suffering of the world is cultivated, it's also engaged, socially engaged. And I'd like to tell the listeners there's an excellent organization called Buddhist Peace Fellowship, which they could Google and get to. And also, as you mentioned, the Buddhist teachings on nature. Can you say something about that?
Well, I can say something because I teach a regular retreat every year at Spiro Rock in Marin County here in Northern California called Natural Liberation, and we sit outside the whole time, and there are several teachers that take retreats that go out, you know, in wilderness areas, and there's a quality of sensing the truth of the fact that we are living in this web of existence, co-arising with the atmosphere, co-arising with the plant kingdom, exchanging, you know, nutrients with the plant kingdom with every breath, and that when you're sitting outside and there are all these other species all around you and sometimes crawling up your leg, that there's a beautiful feeling of non-self, of being connected to everything, and it opens the heart. You begin to sort of see all of life as precious and worthy of protection. It's transformative for people to begin to connect to the natural world. I mean, it's a hunger that we have, being so urban and so, what shall we say, civilized.
Yeah, as if we live on top of nature. That's the industrialized acculturation we get. Well, I wanted to just say just a little bit as we're approaching the end of our conversation about your column you do in every issue, The Dharma and the Drama, which I take it refers to our dramatic monologue going inside our minds at any time. Since you were just talking about nature, the column you did in the current issue, Earth Now, gives us good reason to love all beings as ourselves, including LUCA, L-U-C-A, an acronym, the last universal common ancestor and the ill-fated frog. From marine worms to pre-human primates, all of our ancestors deserve our devotion. What was that column about?
That column was about my fascination with evolution. And I'm not a scientist. I didn't really like science all that much when I was growing up, but I think in coordination with studying myself and studying the Buddhist teaching, I really got interested in science and especially evolution, realizing all of the life forms that have come before us and how, you know, we are related through this elegant spiraling double helix, the DNA, and that the DNA composed of these four chemical compounds, depending on how it's arranged in the long strings of coded information, the DNA will contribute to the growth of a giant sequoia or an ant or a human being. It's like this magic substance that separates life from non-life. And so I read about that, and I read about the scientists had decided that we all come from this one single-celled being that they have named LUCA, the last universal common ancestor. So, if you want ancestor worship, let's start with the first one, and pay respects to LUCA. And then I latched onto the frogs because, as you may know, on the endangered lists, amphibians as a class,
yeah,
not just one species of them, but as a class are threatened,
yeah,
with extinction. We may be losing an entire class of beings. And to imagine that struggle of the amphibians coming from the water up onto the land and trying to learn how to walk on the land, I mean, you could maybe compare it to meditation practice, trying to be mindful. You know, suddenly we're faced with a whole different set of circumstances and requirements for life.
Yeah.
So we shift into a different shape. We grow legs to walk on the land.
We better work out some new socio-political economic shapes. I think you're right. There is a parallel. We're out of time though now, but that was a perfect place to end because it demonstrated this sense of interrelatedness not only with all beings but also back through time. So
absolutely.
If you want to look at those or other work by Wes Nisker, it's on his website, wesnisker.com. That's all the time we have for. I want to thank you, Wes, for coming on All Together Now.
Oh, it was my privilege, Charlene, and I really wish you the best. I hope this program and all the Progressive Network radio network programs gain a lot of listeners and popularity. It's a great service that you're offering the world.
Thank you. Okay, let's amble over to the arts corner, as we do, and see what we have there today. Our poem today is by a Pulitzer Prize-winning poet, Gary Snyder, who has been a Zen Buddhist and a Chan Buddhist for many decades. This poem, which does not have a title, begins with a reference to the Buddhist perception of reincarnation, that the odds are far more likely that one will be reborn as an insect, say, than an animal. I mean, look at the numbers. There are a lot more of them than us. This poem is from a collection of Gary Snyder's poems entitled No Nature, which is a Buddhist reference to no fixed nature. How rare to be born a human being. Wash him off with cedar bark and milkweed. Send the damn doctors home. Baby, baby, noble baby, noble-hearted baby. One hand up, one hand down. Quote, I alone am the honored one, unquote. Birth of the Buddha, as the whole world system trembled, quote, if that baby really said that, I'd cut him up and throw him to the dogs, unquote, said Chow Cho, the Zen master. But chipmunks, gray squirrels, and golden-mantled ground squirrels brought him each a nut, truth being the sweetest of flavors. Girls would have in their arms a wild gazelle or wild wolf cubs and give them their white milk, those who had newborn infants home, breasts still full. Wearing a spotted fawn skin, sleeping under trees, Bacchanates drink on wine or truth, what you will, meaning compassion, agents, man and beast. Beasts got the Buddha nature, all but coyote. And then, for our song today, we'll hear one more written and performed by Wes Scoop Nisker. It's about the dynamic interrelatedness of the material world at the subtle level. This is the Subatomic Shuffle.
There's a dance everybody is doing, if they like it or not. Even when you're sleeping, you're doing it, you just can't stop. You may not know how to make the moves, but every single part of you is in the groove. Doing that subatomic shuffle. Your electrons are spinning around, they do it all night. Your leptons are leaping to the left and to the right. Your photons are flashing on and off, and all your antimatter is real gone stuff. It's all doing that subatomic shuffle. Well, step inside a matter, you'll find a mad hatter. He'll pull you out on the floor. You'll be quivering your quarks while you're dancing in the dark. Your super strings will vibrate more and more. Doing that subatomic shuffle. Now everybody's dancing with you, everybody's in step. The walls are dancing too, and the ceiling is hip. You may think there are things that are not alive, but look a little closer, it's a subatomic jive. It's a subatomic shuffle. Well, inside this dance, you can even find romance. Maybe get into an atom just for two. And if your attraction is strong and you really get along, you'll find a charged particle coming at you. Wants to do that subatomic shuffle with you. You know it's much better with two. The subatomic shuffle. Now they say your atoms keep moving even after you're dead. Some say your mind keeps moving too after it falls out of your head. The scientists will tell you that nothing dies. You can't stop dancing even if you try. Can't stop doing that subatomic shuffle. It's the ultimate bebop. To be or not to be bebop. The subatomic shuffle.
That was The Subatomic Shuffle, written and performed by Wes Nisker from his CD and DVD entitled Crazy Wisdom Saves the World Again. In case you've missed any of these programs, they're available in the archive. If you like this program, please rate it at iTunes. Our theme song is Let's Give Them Something to Talk About, sung by Bonnie Raitt. Join me next week for our Father's Day program, and we'll hear about some relational insights into what's working in the building of a new economy. Till then, this is Charlene Spretnak with All Together Now.